Good afternoon. It's Saturday, January 28th, 2006. This is Michelle Steinberg from Executive Intelligence Review coming to you from Leesburg, Virginia with the LaRouche Show. This week has been a historic fight against fascism in Washington. We have had a successful engagement of the battle to stop the nomination and the confirmation of Judge Samuel Alito on the grounds that Alito is a Nazi who promotes the judicial outlook of Adolf Hitler's crown jurist, Carl Schmitt. And under the title 1933 and Now, Lyndon LaRouche intervened on the United States Senate, especially the Democratic Party, to tell them that time is of the essence. We either stop fascism on the Supreme Court now, or we won't get another chance. Well, the fight has been joined. Senator John Kerry was the first to say he's organizing a filibuster, and he told his fellow Democrats, anybody who says we've got to save our ammunition for a future fight, face it, the future is now. That's the kind of determination we need. And after 1 week of Lyndon LaRouche appearing on the radio in Washington, D.C., 5, 6, 7, 8 times a day in one-minute ads taken out by the LaRouche Political Action Committee, we now have about a dozen U.S. Democratic senators supporting that filibuster. We're on full mobilization through this entire weekend. The first vote on Alito comes Monday at 4:30 p.m. For more information now, Saturday, this is a live show. If you want more information on the Alito fight right now, call 1-888-347-3258. We have literature that is being made available by the LaRouche Political Action Committee, and EIR also is featuring a number of articles about Alito's Schmittlerian fascist doctrine. For the first part of the show today, I want to go to a statement taped earlier today by Mr. LaRouche in a cadre school for the LaRouche Youth Movement, the fastest growing revolutionary creative movement of young people between 18 and 25 years old in this country who are fighting for the future and fighting for freedom. So without further ado, let's hear from Mr. LaRouche's opening remarks. And then in the bottom of the hour, we'll have Jeff Steinberg from EIR, who's written about the Alito case, to answer questions, and a panel of the leading organizers in Washington, D.C., Michelle Lerner and Vincent Milligan, who will have questions for Jeff and comments of their own on this historic battle. Again, this is the LaRouche Show, January 28th. We're going to hear from Lyndon LaRouche's statement taped earlier today.
We might have somebody that knows. All right, quiet down. We're not going to be able to hear Lynn if people don't find their seats. Quiet down.
Lynn, is the level from them okay for you?
It's all right now.
Good.
Who knows what happens next?
Okay.
Morning, Lynn. Are you there?
I'm here. I'm waiting to see what happens on your end there.
All right. We've got voices warmed up this morning. People have their notepads ready for an intense briefing. We're all ready for you.
Okay. Well, I shall go ahead then. Well, you probably notice there's a report that President Bush, who is still looking for his condom after a recent statement he made on a broadcast press conference, appointed two characters from his staff for the Federal Reserve Board. And I wonder what crime they've committed that qualifies them for that position under them. But that's the nature of the thing with Greenspan going out. He's probably going to be go down in history as the Elmer Gantry of of financial monetary policy. The main issue, of course, today internationally is the Alito nomination. This is a pivot point in world history. It's comparable, not quite, of course, but it's comparable by implication to the Reichstag fire and Carl Schmitt's certification of Hitler as a dictator, which dictated Hitler remained from that date on in the immediate aftermath of the Reichstag fire, which was set by Hermann Göring until 1945, until he died. So this it's that kind of ominous event, because at this point you have Cheney, who is not very bright, but who is a tool of certain interests, who are pushing for a collapse of the system, who are pushing for a war involving Iran, who are pushing a scenario which can lead the world into hell. And under this kind of scenario, with a Bush administration which is losing popularity regularly, the Bush is very unpopular now, there is no basis for expecting now anything but an overturn of the composition of the Congress in the coming November elections. So therefore, these guys are desperate with the financial crisis onrushing and with the desperate situation of the current Bush-Cheney administration about the midterm elections coming up this November to do something to pull their situation out of the coals. And with the people behind them who control them, because they don't really control themselves, the people behind them, who are these financial syndicates, are willing to make a great strategic gamble for a grab for world fascist power. So under these conditions, we're extremely dangerous. Now, what's happened is that we had a setback in fighting against this Alito nomination and what it represented, because the leader of the Democratic forces in the Senate, Reid, backed off from assuming leadership against the Alito nomination. And Senator Schumer from New York, who had been designated earlier by circles around Senator Reid to sort of lead the floor fight on this Alito thing, became a little bit demoralized by the way that Reid is reacting. So we had a very bad situation, as you know, in going into last week. We acted, and we not only we acted, but happily the former candidate for presidential election, who was then in Davos, at the meeting in the Davos International Financial Meeting, reacted and assumed the position of saying, I'm going to take the leadership on this issue. Now, Kerry's initiative, with the support of Senator Kennedy on this matter, has reinvigorated the Democratic forces, and we're gaining back what we had apparently lost in terms of a fighting position on the Alito nomination. That's now the case. What is going to happen is not yet decided, but as you know from your neighbors in California, that the California Democratic Party has moved partly with our initiative, but also the initiative of those who we've collaborated with, in turning the situation around in California. So California is now efficiently back in the fight. And you see this by Feinstein has shifted her position to opposing the, actively opposing, as opposed to just opposing, but actively opposing the Alito nomination. So anything can happen. Anything can happen over the weekend. But now we have a reinvigorated effort to fight this Alito nomination. which could be a turning point in world history, a turning point comparable to the Hitler's coming to achieving dictatorial powers. Not that the first step in itself, but the fact if you have a majority on the Supreme Court, which is controlled by this pro-fascist, implicitly pro-Nazi crowd in the Supreme Court, and then the Bush administration or the people behind it pull off a crisis operation under crisis conditions of a confrontation over the use of power between the Congress and the presidency, and the thing is thrown in the direction of the Supreme Court, then the indication that the Supreme Court will support the president on a move to establish a dictatorship like Hitler's would get through. So therefore, stopping this now is extremely important. And what you have is you have a leading role from not exactly behind the scenes by former President Clinton, who is, of course, one of the best fundraisers in his political history, who is now mobilizing forces on the danger of this Alito nomination. This is, at the moment, is the center of the fight to save civilization. And we are deeply involved in this, naturally, and we are a factor in this fight. How much of a factor? Well, let's determine that after the smoke is settled. But we are a factor. We are an important factor in this, and we have to look at ourselves and our responsibilities in terms of the position we occupy as being a key factor in this fight to try to defeat the fascist takeover of the United States. And I don't exaggerate in the slightest in saying fascist takeover. I've already indicated some of the qualifications you might want to raise in discussing how serious the threat is. Whether it's, you know, how does this compare exactly with the situation prior to the Nazi takeover in February 1933 in Germany? Well, that's a moot point. But the very fact that we have to debate that indicates the seriousness of the situation. We do have to debate that. Not because we want to sit and be involved in a debate on this question, because the very fact that we should debate that indicates the seriousness of the situation we're facing. So that's where we stand. Now, in the behind this and in overlapping it is another issue, which I'm addressing in a piece which you saw a glimpse of, or a glimpse of the introduction to, in my latest economic piece, which is coming out in the coming issue of EIR. It's entitled, What Connects the Dots? And you saw that in the briefing lead, or the briefing slug. But the fuller program is much more serious. The problem is, and again, this is something you've been discussing, is the what is an economy? What do we mean by an economy? The key issue, which is very much a focal point of the youth activity today, as a matter of fact, is the keystone. The keystone is physical science and music, but not just physical science and music, but the valid approach to both, to physical science and music. In music, of course, it is the Bach choral method, as exemplified by issues we've raised, by the comma question, as it arises in tuning a choral performance of something like the Verum Corpus of Mozart, again, Mozart's birthday celebration aftermath, and the Bach Jesu meine Freude, and other works. But these are exemplary works in which simply each individual person singing the right notes at the right level does not produce a integrated performance of the actual intention of the composer. To realize the contention, you must modify and temper the modalities of the vocal parts so that they interrelate in a way which creates a unity of effect from beginning to end. And that is what Furtwängler called performing between the notes. Very few people today still understand, relatively speaking, among people who are interested in music, what music is, they know how to make noise. You have these chimpanzee thing, which is called rock performance. It's called rock performance because it's pre-Stone Age performance in terms of intellectual quality. It is highly sexual in the same way that you can see sexuality practiced by chimpanzees and monkeys generally, but it is not, and it may be entertainment for those who like such monkey business in the name of sexual entertainment. But it's not music, and it certainly is not art. It really is not human either. So to convey ideas, which is the ideas which represent discovery of universal physical principles, as they apply in music, you must understand this tempering requirement, which Furtwängler called performing between the notes, which is exemplified in what's called a cappella. That's a misleading term anyway, but it's used for a non-orchestrated performance of a choral performance. But the actual a cappella, which does involve musical instruments, but it's this vocal-only setting or a slightly enhanced vocal setting, as in the case of you require this for the Mozart Ave Verum Corpus. But this, in this case, it's this that defines what music is, because it defines a distinction between monkey music, which you can get on any rock concert or popular concert today, or a copied recording, and real human music, which is based on this principle. And the principle is the same principle of the mind, which occurs in the actual discovery of a universal physical principle, such as gravitation or the principle of quickest time of Fermat. And what we've emphasized as a movement, particularly for the youth movement, is the emphasis on a unified approach to the development of the adult personality or the young adult personality through emphasis upon true creativity as it occurs in the field of physical science. And the same quality, mental quality of creativity, which in music is unique, in a sense, to classical musical composition based on the principles of Bachian tempering. Now, there's some quarrel about this, about so-called Negro music. Now, the so-called Negro spiritual, as developed by the influence of Dvorak on the understanding of musical composition by Harry Burley, resulted in a development of the Negro spiritual in the United States during the early 20th century under the impetus provided by Antonin Dvorak, who had dealt with this thing with folk music in Europe, and who was a student of Brahms, who was also an expert in folk music. You can also see in the work of Mozart and Haydn and Beethoven on folk music before Brahms, in terms of dealing with the setting of certain kinds of Scottish, Irish, and English folk music. And you see exactly how this approach works. So the Negro spiritual, as enhanced and immortalized by the work influence of Dvorak and the work of Berlioz and Berlioz's immediate followers, produced in the American Negro spiritual a form of classical performance, which actually requires all the other qualifications of a Florentine Belcanto voice training. This is not grunting. This is applying the art of tempering, which is derived from a Bachian view of Florentine bel canto voice training to the medium of the Negro spiritual, as insight into this was provided by Dvorak and was developed by Berlioz and his students, such as the great singers of the Negro spiritual of the 20th century. So when we're talking about, in this case, in all these areas, creativity is there. The recognition of the way of putting across the embedded creativity in the Negro spiritual, which is perfected through this Dvorak Burley connection, shows the generality of the principle of creativity in art, especially in singing, because the most human kind of thing in the world is people singing in choral formation and with the various species of voices participating. That is the exemplification of classical music, of classical performance. It's the exemplification of the role of creativity, the distinction of the man from the ape, of the difference between a classical performance and a rock concert, for example. So then you get the same thing in physical science, in the application of the principle of spherics to defining the discovery of universal physical principles, the same principle which is raised by Nicolas Alcuza in his De Docta Ignorantia, which became the birthplace for modern physical science, with the follower of Alcuza, such as Kepler, who lays the foundations of modern physical science in practice, followed by Fermat, who with his quickest time principle, together with the work of Kepler, defines what is the only competent current of modern physical scientific thought. So now our youth movement, coming in the context of the collapse of a culture, a cultural collapse, including the cultural collapse of physical science as practice in an earlier generation, which was largely corrupted because of this Newton-Descartes influence on scientists, which corrupted them and deprived them of the realization of what was otherwise their natural creative contributions to scientific progress. Now, we have a youth generation which is getting in on the ground floor, so to speak, in music and in science of these things. This is getting on the ground floor of a social principle of a society which is based on a conscious mobilization around the creative powers which are uniquely the property of the human species and no other species. This is the entry, the conscious entry into what Vladimir Vygotsky defined as the noosphere. So we're now entering the noosphere. Now, what I'm addressing in this case, in this present paper, is exactly that. We need a science of economy and a programmatic approach to the present world crisis of economy, of physical economy, which is based on this concept. And therefore, we must define economy not as in terms of Cartesian terms or mechanistic terms or conventional empiricist terms. We must define economy in terms of creativity. Now, an economy has two sides to it. On the one side, we have what is called the monetary side. The monetary side, which is treated by Marx and the Marxists and others, as well as the usual crowd, as the basis for economics, is incompetent. It's intrinsically incompetent. Marxism and the conventional economics is intrinsically incompetent scientifically, because it is based on the assumption that there is a lawful relationship, or a statistically lawful relationship, between the circulation of money and economy. And that is not true. That is a great fraud. All economics as generally taught, including Marxian economics as well as the varieties you can find in any university today, is essentially fraudulent. That doesn't mean all the people who practice it are incompetent. They do have some useful insights here and there. But their systemic conception of what an economy is a fraudulent one. Now, here we are with the greatest collapse of world economy the world could imagine. It's been onrushing for 40 years since the second half of the 1960s. We've been degenerating. We've been degenerating under the influence, the increasing influence of a degeneration. It's called the degeneration. It's called the baby boomer generation. The people who came into leading positions associated with the 68ers, the 68er phenomenon. So we have a cultural paradigm shift, which is introduced as a complication of the intrinsic incompetence of economic thinking, which now becomes called post-industrial society, or a services economy. This is the ultimate insanity, the ultimate mass insanity, which is the actual basis threatening the existence of a world economy and threatening to plunge the world as a whole today into a new dark age, in which the level of the human population will sink rapidly from a present level of over 6 billion people to a population of significantly less than 1 billion people within the course of approximately a generation. And a disappearance of entire language cultures, of whole other aspects of cultures, the disappearance of nationality as a relic of the past, and the degradation of humanity largely to something resembling rutting, cannibalistic beasts, unless we stop it. So now the question is, we need a mold of economy which gets us out of this mess. And this means we have to go to the understanding of what an economy is. There are two aspects to any modern economy. One aspect, which is popular, is the monetary aspect, the use of money as a medium of exchange and for other things, as diapers or whatever. The second thing is the physical economy. Now, physical economy is not simply an equilibrium of the relationship among the physical components of economy, including human labor and human existence. But an economy is actually, to get a profit in a physical economy, the profit cannot exceed the rate of growth, the rate of physical growth, the rate of increase of productivity per capita and per square kilometer. Now, the only sustainable basis for such an increase in per capita output and standard of living to compensate for attrition, that is the depletion of certain resources and things like that, is scientific creativity. The scientific creativity, which we are addressing as in the recent Christmas issue of EIR, and the application of spherics to find what we mean by a universal physical principle, taking some elementary examples up through the implications of the work of Kepler and Fermat, and which means going through the work of Leibniz, through the circles of Gauss and Riemann. So therefore, we have to apply that. But you look at the economic textbooks, the economic policy making, you find a hopeless confusion and desperate incompetence on economic thinking in all circles. Therefore, we have, and I have in particular, a unique responsibility for making what is a real economy clear to people who may be intelligent, but who really don't understand economics. Now, what we have, of course, are people who know how to practice machine tool practice design, which is an expression of the process of realization of scientific discoveries and their application. We have the means for programmatically approaching the question of increasing the productivity, physical productivity, per capita, per square kilometer on this planet. We have that. I have the theory. I have the scientific theory which enables us to understand this. And we have, in general, no systematic understanding of political economy or economy otherwise which is competent for this purpose except my own. And that's what I'm doing. And that's what this next paper in progress is going to address in a more specific way. It does not replace what I've written otherwise and earlier on this thing, but it supersedes it by going to the clinching point of what do you actually mean by an economy? What is the difference between me and all my rivals who are incompetent by comparison, especially in light of the crisis which faces us now? If what I'm doing in this respect is not adopted as the leading policy of civilization now, from our own government on, then the planet has not much of a chance of avoiding a new dark age. We've run out of all other options. Okay, that's it. Have fun.
You've been listening to Lyndon LaRouche giving a presentation to the California LaRouche Youth Movement on Saturday, January 28, 2006. That was a pre-recorded portion of Mr. LaRouche's cadre school with the LaRouche Youth Movement. I'm Michelle Steinberg, speaking to you from Leesburg, Virginia, on Saturday, January 28th. The topic of today's show is the mobilization to stop the fascist Samuel Alito from getting a seat on the Supreme Court. I'm going to give a little information about how to get in touch with the LaRouche movement during this next 24 hours especially, and then go to our guests, Jeffrey Steinberg from EIR, Michelle Lerner, and Vincent Milligan from the LaRouche Youth Movement in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. So, www.larouchepac, LaRouchePac.com is the place to go for all of the information on the fight to impeach Dick Cheney and immediately to stop the confirmation of Judge Samuel Alito. On January 11th, 2006, in an international webcast, Lyndon LaRouche began his presentation with the very moving statement, "These are the times that try men's souls." That webcast has now been turned into a pamphlet complete with questions and answers from some of the country's leading elected officials and political figures, from the National Black Caucus, from the U.S. Senate and Congress, from the media. That is also available as a DVD of the entire presentation. To find out about this literature and other activities of Lyndon LaRouche and our worldwide LaRouche movement, call 1-888-347-3258. To participate in today's show by email, please send your email questions to radio@larouchepub.com. We're now going to go to the live portion of our show. I have Jeff Steinberg in the studio here with me, and Jeff has just written an article for the upcoming issue of EIR, The Alito Fight, LaRouche Says No to a Replay of Germany, 1933 to 1934. And my question to Jeff is, what is the relationship between this organization known as the Federalist Society and its affinity and admiration for Carl Schmitt, and what we've seen in the last 5 years of this Bush administration in terms of perpetual war, a clash of civilizations, secrecy, spying on the American people, and moves towards a dictatorship? How does this fit into what we've had suffered under over this last period?
Well, first of all, Judge Samuel Alito is a central figure in the Federalist Society, which is an organization among law school students and lawyers that was founded in 1982 by the same right-wing foundations that are also behind the neoconservative apparatus that brought you the Iraq War, among other things. And this is also the same apparatus that has financed, within the law schools of the United States, a rehabilitation of the Nazi jurist, the crown jurist of Hitler, Carl Schmitt. Now, the central issue in the debate over the Alito nomination right now is what's been referred to as Alito's support for the idea of, quote, the unitary executive. What this concept really is an endorsement of executive branch dictatorship. When Carl Schmitt talked about this same idea in Germany right after the Reichstag fire, he gave it a different name. He called it the Führerprinzip, the principle of the Führer, the great dictator, the charismatic leader who in times of crisis is the law and supersedes any kind of legislative or judicial checks and balances on presidential power. So Alito is a representative of a outright Nazi concept of law that we saw in Germany, particularly between 1933 with the Reichstag fire and the summer of 1934, which was the time frame in which Hitler consolidated his dictatorship and began the policy of genocide and mass extermination, starting inside Germany itself. That's what Alito represents. And that's the philosophy that he would bring to the court if he were allowed to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate next week as the replacement for Judge Sandra Day O'Connor. So the Alito fight is literally a fight against the introduction of unconstitutional, illegal, outright Nazi principles of law here in the United States. And it's completely consistent with the drive that has been openly acknowledged by Vice President Cheney to constitute presidential dictatorship. We see it with the president's assertion that because he is the commander-in-chief, he has the right to organize and order the NSA and other agencies to spy on Americans on the flimsiest of excuses, in violation of laws that were passed by the Congress and were actually signed into law by earlier presidents.
Jeff, somebody in this debate said that without Carl Schmitt, without the unitary executive, this so-called approach to the war on terrorism wouldn't be possible. What do you have to say about that?
Well, Schmitt personifies this kind of argument. I mean, Schmitt has, I think, two things that he uniquely contributes to the ideology of the Bush administration, particularly the Cheney neoconservative crowd. And remember, it's Cheney's general counsel and now chief of staff, David Addington, who is really the proponent of this executive dictatorship idea. The first thing is that Schmitt says that the charismatic leader, as hard as it is to imagine describing George Bush or Dick Cheney as a charismatic leader, but he says the charismatic leader during a period of crisis is the law, and that he directly represents the will of the people and therefore can do anything he pleases. Schmitt argued that our form of government in this country, checks and balances, separation of power, and the idea of political consensus is completely unacceptable. It doesn't work. And that what you need is a totalitarian state with a unitary, charismatic leader to run the show. So, I mean, that's the notion of law that's being pushed by the Bush administration. It's illegal, it's unconstitutional, it's an impeachable crime in and of itself. The second thing, and this gets us to something that people will recognize as the psychology of Carl Schmitt. In a book-length thing that he wrote in the 1930s or 40s called On the Political, Schmitt said that the highest form of warfare is politics, that politics is a zero-sum game. There are winners and losers. There's no compromise. There's no middle ground. And there are no rules. And that, therefore, power is everything. So when Democrats come up against the kind of politics practiced by Dick Cheney or Karl Rove or Jack Abramoff, for that matter, they're operating at a certain kind of disadvantage unless they understand this factor. Because for Rove and company, victory is everything. You lie, you cheat, you steal in order to win. And, you know, the fact that we still are looking back on the last two presidential elections with a growing conviction that those elections were stolen and that, in fact, Bush didn't win either of them, gives you an indication that you're dealing with a bunch of people who believe, as Hobbes did, that politics is warfare of each against all and that power is everything and, therefore, there are no rules. So this is the legacy of Schmitt, without which this administration would have been brought down long ago, probably would have never come into office in the first place.
Well, let's go to Michelle Lerner from Washington, D.C., who's been on the front lines of organizing this filibuster to block the Schmidt confirmation. Michelle, are you there?
Yes. One thing I was reflecting upon was that the importance of this fight is not only in defeating this, what we're calling Schmidt-Larian move toward dictatorship, but it's also critical for carrying out the paradigm shift that's going to be necessary to put the country back on the right footing, if you will. And it's an interesting thing being on the front lines is in the way that we have been, because our organization is playing a key role in bridging a gap that has been existing between the population and the governmental institutions, the Congress and the population. And over the past year, mainly over the past year, there's been a shift in the Democratic Party toward the policies of Roosevelt and Kennedy. But one of the main difficulties is that the Democrats have had to face the setback of being the minority party since 2002.
Right.
Where this year is an election year, and a huge world of difference, there'll be a huge world of difference if the Democrats actually win the elections in such a way that they retake the majority. We'll see a complete shift in the potential of what can be done with the government institutions. So I'm seeing this fight as critical also in establishing for the population a real sense that we're dealing with a changed Democratic Party. Because there's been a lot of good that has come up, particularly one example is on the question of the filibuster itself, that they fought to maintain the ability to filibuster, and they fought in such a way that a number of Republicans actually joined that fight. And now we have this question of the fight to actually use the filibuster, that they've been transformed over the past year, but a lot of the population still is in the dark. So being a part of the organization, we're carrying out the process of bridging the gap between the population and the governments, but I see as critical that if the Democrats do fight in the way that is necessary at this point in time, it will further establish the idea to the population that they are a changing party. And that the vote in 2006 is much more than what generally people have been thinking about in terms of elections and the population.
Well, Michelle, we have a question from Paris. We'll go to in a minute. Before that, I want to ask you this. Last week on Saturday, this time, there was no filibuster formally. What did you do over the last week? What changed the situation? Elaborate, please, on this relationship between the people, the population, the real government of this nation, and its representatives.
Well, we've been on an all-out mobilization. We've brought back a sound card, something that we did during the primaries, during the previous election campaigns. We've been playing this ad that was aired on WTOP. The ad of LaRouche is particularly a part out of the webcast that he gave on January 11th, making the issue clear that what Alito represents is Hitler being brought in to the United States. That there's no room for Hitler under our constitutional system, making that issue clear, as opposed to people being wrapped up in abortion or something like this, because there's also been a lot of opposition by the right-wing fundamentalist crowd toward what we've been doing. A lot of these right-wing Christian fundamentalists have been coming out rallying, trying to use this issue of abortion as if that's what the political fight is about. And these guys have been putting pressure on the population to back Alito. But we've been counteracting that by making it clear that the issue is not abortion, the issue is fascism. So that's one thing we've been doing. There's been a lot of distribution of the Children of Satan 4 pamphlets, the statement that was just released, 1933 and now, the statement just released by LaRouche. There's quite some polarization in the population at large, but then also we've been targeting a number of these professors on the universities who were part of the Federalist Society and intervening in the classrooms to expose to their students that they're being taught by individuals who support the ideas of the unitary executive, essentially the ideas that had paved the way for dictatorship in Germany. So we've been causing some outrages, as evidenced by the article written in the GW, the George Washington University paper, The Hatchet. Some of them were somewhat shocked about what we had done.
Well, tell people about, the first thing that's a shocker is the cover of The Children of Satan 4. What kind of reaction has that gotten on the streets?
Well, I mean, we've been, as far as on deployments, we've been having a lot of signs regarding this question of Alito and Cheney, their connection to what happened in Germany in 1933. There's this one A-frame picture that we have up a lot where it has Hitler's face replaced with Dick Cheney, and there's a person next to Hitler saluting, and it's got Alito's head where that person's head was. And it's really funny because it looks real. And this generated, especially on Capitol Hill, like Union Station and Cap South area, generated a real polarization effect where people were just, because you're dealing with an environment that's like 90% fear. So no matter how many times people try to dismiss what we're saying based on, our, quote, approach to our organizing and even their objections to not liking Lyndon LaRouche when most of the times they don't even know what they're objecting to, they just cannot – it's not a substitute for this fear factor is what FDR called it, unjustified terror. So the psychological intensity is growing every day on this question of why we're calling this, how we're approaching this in terms of calling these guys Nazis.
Vinny, could you tell the audience what can they do now that the filibuster is in play? What are the marching orders?
Basically, if you haven't gotten out and organized the population to get them to call their senators, it's a little more difficult here because sometimes you don't know whether or not you're running into people living in D.C., but they still, as far as getting the literature out, getting people to understand that, as Michelle said, the issue is fascism. This is a question of, for example, I was talking to this guy the other day, and he just could not understand what the whole fight was. So I brought in this question of, well, you've got 1933. It wasn't Hitler's, iron fist, as most of it's taught today in schools and so forth. This was a banker coup, pretty much. They're trying to install Alito because the economy's collapsing. So that's the message that's all I can tell you is put that message out there is that it's the question of economics. And an economy that's collapsing, you have a banker mindset which is going to install people like Alito,
Okay, yeah. Good. Jeff wanted to add something or another comment. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I just wanted to really reinforce what both Michelle and Vinny just said, because I spent a good deal of this past week up on Capitol Hill. And one of the things that I found is that you've got a problem with this disconnect from the population among the senators themselves. Some of the Democrats who are running for re-election in November in the so-called red states are being bamboozled by Karl Rove. You know, Karl Rove has these, you know, robo phone bank operations where, you know, computer-generated voices are calling into these offices, inundating them with demands that they have to endorse Alito or this person or that person is going to put up millions of dollars to run against them. And to a certain extent, these intimidation tactics are working on some of the Democrats because they've been more disconnected than they should be from their own constituents. You know, and we've gone in and we've told them, look, the population in many instances is way ahead of the elected officials. You know, you had this event 2-3 weeks ago, sponsored by Congressman Jim Moran in Alexandria, Arlington, in Northern Virginia. And he invited Congressman John Murtha, who took the point in saying we've got to get the American troops out of Iraq. And usually a town hall meeting sponsored by Congressman Moran will bring 50 or 100 people. But in this case, 1,100, 1,200 people showed up. People had to be turned away at the door. And the general mood of the audience was, we want this administration impeached now. And they were holding the congressmen and the senators feet to the fire to really represent them in Washington and lead this fight against what the population perceives as a bunch of fascists at the White House. So the work that we're doing in bridging this gap between the population and the elected officials is absolutely going to be vital if the Democrats are going to take advantage of the opportunity and win a landslide in November. Because I think that what Michelle said about this need to change the character of government in Washington through a Democratic landslide victory, this is absolutely vital.
Jeff is quoting Michelle Lerner's comments there on the 2006 elections. This is Michelle Steinberg. I'm going to read now the question from Bertrand in Paris with the LaRouche Youth Movement there. He says, it's hard from here to understand the procedures. What is the schedule now? When will the whole Senate vote? What are the consequences of their vote, whether they vote yes or no? And what about the filibuster? Jeff, you want to take that piece by piece?
Sure. Well, you have right now an ongoing debate on the floor of the Senate on the Alito nomination. And late last week, the Senate Majority Leader, Bill Frist, introduced what's called a cloture motion. And what that means, in effect, is that by schedule, on Monday afternoon at 4:30, there will be a vote in the Senate over whether or not the debate will be closed and the nomination of Alito will be called for a vote. And so the first key event coming up is going to be the vote on whether to end the debate or whether it will continue. And so to win the cloture vote, it will be required to get a, I think, 61 votes. 60 votes.
Out of 100.
Out of 100 votes in the Senate. And if there are 60 votes for cloture, then on Tuesday, the full Senate will do an up or down vote on the Alito nomination. Now, if the cloture vote is defeated, and at this point I would say there's a reasonable chance that it will be defeated, then the debate will continue until another cloture vote is introduced, and ultimately this would then potentially trigger a filibuster in which the Democrats declare that we intend to keep the debate open And the debate will go on infinitely until the Alito nomination is withdrawn. So that's the essentials of what's going to play out. Now, Tuesday is Bush's State of the Union address in the evening, and the White House desperately wants the Alito nomination to be approved before Bush gives his State of the Union. And I think at this point there's a very good chance that will not happen. There's other technicalities and other procedures that could come into play, but I think for now that's the basic picture of what we're looking at next week.
Over the last 24 hours, we have seen some of the country's leading senators go from a position of saying there was no hope for a filibuster or they were against a filibuster to changing their position. One such example is California, which in many ways was the birthplace of the national LaRouche youth movement. And last night at the Black Caucus of the Democratic Central Committee of the Democratic Party, which is having its convention in Los Angeles, a resolution was passed, a resolution to take whatever measures, including filibuster, to defeat the confirmation of Samuel Alito to the U.S. Supreme Court. This was introduced by Quincy, one of the LIM members. He gave a speech motivating it passed the African American Caucus. It went today to the
Resolutions Committee.
The Resolutions Committee, and after much debate, it passed there. However, the Resolutions Committee had somebody who insisted that we had to take out, or they had to take out, the reference to Adolf Hitler and Carl Schmitt. Well, nonetheless, it passed, and it's going to go to the complete Democratic Party convention floor. LaRouche has said over and over again, you got to go with the Hitler issue. It's the only thing that works. It's the only thing that makes sense, going to the heart and soul of the American system, that this system is against dictatorship. It's against fascism. Well, but the massive mobilization is what turned around Dianne Feinstein, and this could be done. It should be done now in Maryland, where Barbara Mikulski is said she's against the filibuster. We have a lot of work to do. We have a couple of minutes left. I want to again go to the front lines in Washington and turn the remaining few minutes over to Vincent and Michelle Lerner. So go ahead, Michelle.
Well, actually, I just had a question for you.
Well, this is Vincent. Okay, go ahead.
I mean, given that what's going on right now, I mean, after Monday, I guess that's when the vote is. If Alito is not actually confirmed, what measures do you think the administration is going to take, or who do you think they're going to try to put forward to replace him?
You know, it's a good question. I think that that the inclination of the Cheney crowd is going to be to be in your face and to come back with another completely egregious fascist nominee. Now, remember that President Bush initially had nominated Harriet Myers, his own White House general counsel, who was not a member of the Federalist Society, does not by appearance seem to be part of this outright Carl Schmitt fascist fan club. So I think, you know, you've got the potential for all sorts of splits even in the administration. The point right now, though, is a defeat of Alito will be a decisive defeat for fascism. It will be a decisive defeat for Dick Cheney and the faction that he represents, who are the hardcore dictatorship crowd. So I think no matter what they do, no matter how they regroup, defeating Alito is a grave setback for those who want a Nazi dictatorship over the United States. And whatever they do after that will be done from a position of significant weakness relative to where they are right now.
That's all the time we have for now. Again, get in touch with EIR in the LaRouche movement, you can call 1-888-347-3258. 347-3258. Get an update every single day this week. Thanks for joining us. Come in next week for the LaRouche Show for next Saturday.